is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, transform your training this May with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Get $3,000 off any commercial machine in the month of May. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
This is Eric Gabriel, men's assistant basketball coach at High Point University, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sokol tonight. And we are jumping on to what we thought might be an NBA Finals preview. But unfortunately, the Boston Celtics were able to beat the Miami Heat tonight. So we are not going to do our finals preview, but we are going to talk some Eastern and Western Conference finals. We'll talk some Denver Nuggets. We'll talk some LA Lakers. And I think we're going to start out by talking Heat Celtics, but do you have a game for me?
I do. So tonight, the Celtics stole one. See where I'm going with this? They stole one in Miami.
All right.
So we're going to go NBA career, all-time career leaders in steals, Mike.
In the playoffs.
In the playoffs, sorry.
Okay. So LeBron.
Number one.
Jordan.
Number three.
Scottie Pippen.
Number two.
So I've got three. John Stockton.
Five.
All right, so I only need number four. A lot of pressure on this one. Tony Parker.
Tony Parker is not on the list. He is not in the top. Okay. Not in the top 20. Let's see if I can find
him. That was a letdown.
He's 33, Mike. Yikes.
That was a letdown. All right. Let me think. Steals. Who else would be up there near the top? Kobe?
Kobe six.
Let's see. Who else has been? Man. Tim Duncan?
No. Guard. We like his tweets.
Magic.
Magic.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you recently send me a Magic Johnson tweet?
I believe I did.
Or did I just read it on my own?
Who knows? Let's see what he wrote tonight.
Oh, it was the one about the Celtics being embarrassment. Did you send that to me?
I did not.
Magic said something like, I never thought
in my 44 years of being In my 44 years of being associated with the NBA, I never thought I'd see a Boston Celtics team, a franchise with 17 champions, quit. I know fellow Celtics fans all over the world must be disgusted and devastated. The Miami Heat blew them out, 128-102 in Game 3.
Pretty obvious, but also pretty – that's pretty blunt coming from Magic.
It is.
He's got to do. All right, well, I got four out of the top five pretty easily, so not too bad. I've been doing pretty good on these playoff ones, although there's a lot – the pool is a lot smaller from who to choose from. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you're doing pretty well. So tonight, Mike, the Heat tried to close the Celtics out. The Celtics did not allow them to close them out. You know, part of me was like, there's no way the NBA lets this happen regardless of – how the game looks, because you realize, Mike, if they didn't win tonight, we were going to be without an NBA game for 10 days. Because the finals is not starting on June 1st, and no matter what, that's not starting. There was no way that this game was going to happen.
Nine, 7 days.
I guess when you wake up tomorrow, it's 8 days. Yes, but still,
we'll be on the eighth day.
That's bad for business, Mike. Bad for business in the NBA. But I thought for sure the Lakers were going to win last night. We'll get there in a little bit. But like, the Celtics came out. They looked good to start. Then the Heat got up to a 9-point lead in the first half, and they looked like they were in control of the game, and in the start of the second half, it was a 15-0 run. And then from there, the Celtics just controlled. I mean, Grant Williams hit four threes. Come on. And they just looked better, like the better team today. After that game three, the Celtics should be embarrassed, like Magic said. Like, that was terrible. I was sitting there watching it on what day was that? It was Sunday. I was watching it. I just gotten home and went to the PGA. I watched the game on Friday night. My dad was so excited when the Heat won again, because he hates the Celtics, just like you and I. And then Sunday, they just got blown out, and I thought the series was over. But then once the Lakers lost last night, I was like, "Oh, there's gonna be some way the Celtics are gonna get reinvigorated and they're gonna win this game, because the NBA is not gonna be happy if they have to wait 8 days without an NBA playoff game." And I think Charles Barkley on the pregame and halftime show was really hoping like that his season was over. I don't know if you listened.
Charles is rooting hard for it.
Oh, yeah,
he really wants to get home, baby.
Yeah. So, anyways, the bottom line is this. I still think the Heat now are winning this series, but if the Celtics go home and they win game five, that puts all the pressure on Miami to get a game six, right? Like, there's no – like, the Celtics down 3-0, they win game four, okay? They go home and they take care of business game five. The Heat do not want anything to do with going back to game seven in Boston. So they need to get that win. And I don't know, you know, depending on how things shake out, whether we're going to record again before, like when the series officially ends, we'll probably have to record something for the finals if it's, you know, whatever. But I just don't see how the Miami Heat are going to want to go back to Boston for game seven if Boston somehow wins on Thursday. Your thoughts, Mike?
I have a lot of thoughts on this. I think number one is tonight's game combined with Sunday's game. It's sort of a microcosm of who and what the Boston Celtics are, and kind of what we've talked about over and over again on the podcast when it comes to both the Celtics as a team and their individual players. Like, Tatum tonight was really, really good, but he's been pretty bad in these first three games. And it just feels like, again, is he a guy who can be the best player on the floor in a huge game? The answer to that question is yes. I mean, he's proven it multiple times in the last 2 years. when you think about his 51 against the Sixers in Game 7, and then you think about his Game 6 last year against Milwaukee, where he came up huge in these big spots. And then there's other times where it feels like he disappears. And like I said last week, I really feel like Tatum's a guy who his ceiling is super, super high, but his floor is also really, really low. And you just don't know on a given night what version of him you're going to get. And that,
It's a Jekyll and Hyde situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what Boston is. Like, they were terrible the other night. Tonight, they were – I don't think they were lights out tonight. I don't think Miami played very well tonight. But Boston was good enough tonight to win. And Tatum obviously was, I think, the best player on the floor tonight. But that doesn't mean he's going to be the best player on the floor come Game 5. And he certainly hasn't been the best player on the floor in the first three games. So – Tatum, you just don't know what you're getting. And then take it a step further, when you talk individual players with the Celtics, Jaylen Brown, who knows what you're getting from him. Now, Jaylen Brown is a second-team All-NBA guy. When you watch Jaylen Brown, do you feel or are you inspired with any confidence that Jaylen Brown is going to do great things in the moment? Now, again, he's had tremendous games. He averaged, 26, 27 points a game this year, and does a ton of good things, but I just don't think that, again, his floor is 10 points in a game. And I just think that that's not how I perceive a guy who's second team all NBA. And maybe that's me overvaluing what I think a guy who's second team all NBA should be. But Jaylen Brown, from one game to the next, you just don't know really what you're getting. And if I'm the Celtics, that makes me nervous. I'm a Celtics fan. I think what's interesting, too, as you think about this series is no team in NBA history has come back from 3-0 down, right? So typically, when you think of a team that's going to be down 3-0 in a series, you're talking about a team that is on the road for the first two games. But in this case, Boston was at home for the first two games. So they're down 3-0 and already have two home games in the rearview mirror that they lost. But yet, if you think about, hey, can a team possibly come back from 3-0? And I think you laid out part of the case in that if Boston goes home and wins Game 5, which seems, I guess, not unlikely, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Now you're going back to Miami, Game 6, as you said, a lot of pressure at that point on Miami because they obviously want to close it out and win that home game. Now, that's not to say that Miami's not capable of losing three in a row and then going into Boston and having the two guys that we just talked about not live up to their potential, and Jimmy Butler in Game 7. I think I'd be more likely to bet on the best version of Butler showing up in Game 7 than the best version of Brown and Tatum. But I certainly wouldn't want to be in that position if I was Miami, if I didn't have to. And certainly I don't want to lose three in a row. But on a bigger scale, you think about the Miami is an eighth seed. They had, during the regular season, the 27th ranked offense in the NBA. They're a team that was, I believe, somewhere around that same number, 26, 27, in three-point shooting. And against Boston and against the Bucks, they've shot the ball really well. Now, they came back to earth tonight from three, and they were only 8 for 32. But statistically, I think they had a negative point differential during the season. And then you look at Boston.
They're the only team in NBA history to get to the conference finals with a negative point differential.
Okay, so there you go. Boston, I believe, had the highest point differential in the league, which typically that portends a team that is a powerhouse, that's one of the elite title contenders. They still have, moving forward, they have two more games at home. They have a potential Game 7 at home. So if you ever had a situation where a team was set up that is a 3-0 comeback possible, this is almost the ideal scenario. You've got a team that I think most people would agree going into the series and over the course of the history of these two teams that Boston is, quote, the better team. They've certainly had the statistical profile for that. And Miami has been playing great in the playoffs. But if you think about, is there some regression to the mean coming, that it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that Boston could storm back and go win this series in seven games just because of the statistical profile. And then you laid out the case of just how it goes back and forth, home, away, all that kind of stuff. So is it possible? Yes. And at the same time, you and I watched game three. That was one of the most miserable performances by a team that looked like they were ready to go on vacation and honestly could have cared less about.
They were getting ready to grind that banana boat. They're getting
ready to grind the banana. Maybe you could say that they got hit by maybe you could say they got hit by a shovel and they just got wobbled and they never recovered, and hey, it's one game and you move on and now you come back and you're ready to play, and maybe that's the way Boston looked at it. But it's still hard to look at what we looked at on Sunday night in game three from a psychological standpoint, from a body language standpoint, from a post-game press conference standpoint, and think that that was a team that was poised to come back and continue to win and try to get back into the series. Now, I did not expect Boston to win tonight. I expected the game to maybe go similar to the Lakers game, although I kind of felt like Miami was going to take care of business early and that this game wasn't going to be one that went down to the wire the way that the Lakers-Nuggets game went down to the wire on Monday night. But, man, it was hard to envision this after watching what Boston threw together in Game 3. So I don't really know what to expect moving forward. It's hard to believe that Miami is going to let Boston win four in a row based on the mental toughness that this team has showed over the course of this playoff run and what we know Jimmy Butler is capable of. It's got to feel like there's going to be one Jimmy Butler game where he's going to go for 40 plus and just kind of carry him, and that the Heat's role players are going to shoot better from three. I find it hard to believe that Boston's going to win three in a row. But like I said, the statistical profile of these two teams says that if a team was ever going to come back from 3-0, that this Boston team potentially, at least from a statistical standpoint, is that team.
So I got some stats for you, Mike. You ready for some stats?
Throw them at me.
Okay.
Yep.
The Celtics in their last 14 games are 7-1 when making 15 plus threes. If they made less than 15 threes, they're 0-6. Okay.
So that's the make or miss league theory, right? So Boston tonight goes 18 for 45 from three, shoots 40%. The Heat go 8 for 32 from three. They shoot 25%. Flip those two percentages around, and it's a completely different game. Miami probably wins it. And so make or miss.
Make or miss. Okay, Tatum is now the Celtics' all-time leading leader in points per game in the playoffs, which – you take that however you want, okay? Jason Tatum, fourth quarter buckets this series, Mike. Tonight he had 5 fourth quarter buckets. How many did he have the whole rest of the series in the fourth quarter combined?
Yeah, 0.
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, okay. Good job paying attention to the broadcast. I'm proud of you, Mike. Grant Williams poked the bear the other night, but tonight he got 14 points. He's 4-6 from behind the arc. What do you think his percentage is from behind the arc in the series, Mike?
In this series?
In the series. It's Grant Williams.
I'm trying to think what he shot the other night. I'd say it's probably 45%.
60%, Mike.
Okay.
So?
What's his attempts in... makes. Do you have that?
No, I don't know. I haven't said the percentage. And the last thing, Al Horford tonight made 3 3-pointers. He's the only center that we can classify as a center in NBA history with 145-plus postseason 3-pointers. So, I don't know. Does that mean Nowitzki doesn't have 145 3-pointers? I find that hard to believe, but maybe – Because Nowitzki was technically a center, right?
He was probably considered to be a power forward, so that's probably where you're. That's probably where that's happening.
Okay, but
that's where I'm.
Some interesting things. Anyways, I think the Heat are going to win the series. I just can't fathom Celtics winning in seven. But I also don't want the Celtics to win. So maybe that's part of my problem. I want the Heat to win. So I'm going to take the Heat in six, Mike.
Yeah, I'll go Heat in six. I'll go Heat in six as well.
Join my bandwagon. Okay, sweet. I like it. All right. Anything else on that series that we want to talk about? Or are we going to spend the bulk of the rest? I think it's time to move on, in my opinion. But do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, one other thing to talk about. Okay, Joe Mazzulla. What's your thoughts?
I mean, he played against Jimmy Butler and lost in the NCAA tournament, right? In the conference tournament. I didn't even realize he was like that prominent of a player that he was like on a D1.
Played at West Virginia.
I don't think he's a good coach, Mike. He doesn't like. Let's be honest, Mike. When the game was an 8-point game with like six minutes or 7 minutes left, did you say all this is setting up for another Celtics failure? Did you think that at all during? I thought that. So that's not an indicator of a good coach, in my opinion. But
when you see him on a sideline, when they cut to him, what is your impression of how he looks when they cut to him on the sideline at any point during the game?
Confused,
exactly. Like he's a guy who he reminds me a lot. We had this conversation about Coach Bud.
Well,
no, Coach Bud, many times.
Ty Lue used to look at that when he'd be like,
but Ty Lue looked confused in that maybe he was trying to figure stuff out or he was confused about what he saw because he didn't like it. Mazzulla and then Coach Bud, I always feel like when you look at them on the sideline, they look like we have no idea what is going on, what we're supposed to do, how we can change what's happening, or how we can continue what's happening that's good.
Kind of like Freddie Kitchens, Mike?
Yeah, exactly. It just looks like they would engender, if I was a player and I looked over at my sideline to my head coach and I saw Joe Mazzulla standing over there with the confused and dazed look on his face, it would not engender any confidence whatsoever in what our team was doing. And look, I think he's had problems from a coaching standpoint, and a lot of the things have been well documented in terms of just making adjustments and what lineups he's throwing out there and timeouts and all these different things. But to me, it's just like a feel where when I look at what he's doing and I see his body language and facial expressions, like so much of a coach is, do you project confidence and do you give your players confidence through what you say, what you do, your, I don't want to say authoritarianism, but do you seem like a guy who has things under control, who knows what's going on, who the players believe in? And when I look at Mazzulla on the sideline, that's what I don't see. I just don't see a guy who projects confidence. I see a guy who projects confusion.
So someone tweeted this, Mike, and Simmons, of course, retweeted it. Joe Mazzulla calls a quick timeout with 9:41 left in the fourth, lead down to five. Marcus Smart immediately sits down in the coach's chair in front of the bench and talks his teammates through the game plan.
And now look, right? Phil Jackson would get credit for that. Hey, he's letting the players take control of the team, and he's confident enough that they can do that. So you can read that in a bunch of different ways, right? Because in coaching circles, how many coaches have we talked about where they talk about it's a player-led team? And so are there moments where the coach can turn things over to a player? I think the answer to that is yes. At the same time, I think this goes back to what I was just saying, where the perception of what happened there is, okay, Joe Mazzulla has no idea what he's doing, so Marcus Smart now has to take over. Or David Blatt back in the day has no idea what he's doing, so LeBron has to override his play call so that he could take the shot against the Bulls to hit the game winner. And so it's all a matter of the perception of who that coach is and what that coach is all about. And obviously, if you're Phil Jackson and you're halfway through your tenure with the Chicago Bulls, you've pretty much earned the right to do whatever you want. You can not call timeout and say, hey, my team's working through it. Or you can sit over on the side and let Jordan and Pippen run the huddle. And people are going to say, oh, what a great coach. What great strategy to allow the players to take control of the situation. Whereas if you're Joe Mazzulla and now Marcus Smart is sitting down in your chair and he's taking over the huddle, and it's because you don't know what you're doing. And part of that is reality. Part of that is the perception of who you are and where you are in your career. So I don't know that that in and of itself, right, doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't know what he's doing. But I think, like what I said, to me, I'm just going by, I'm not in his practices every day. I don't know what's being said in the locker room. But I know when I look at him on the sideline, if I was a player and I looked at him standing over there, it would not make me feel confident just the way that
he wouldn't feel inspired and empowered to make a difference.
No, Mike. And look, and that may be a silly way to analyze a coach. And I'm not sure that from a technical aspect, it really means anything. But part of being a coach is the psychology of being a coach and how you impact your team. And no player on the team currently is going to ever be honest about that situation, probably, unless they want the guy fired. Right. But
James Harden,
I just feel like when you look at this, when you look at the sideline, I just don't think that he doesn't engender confidence in me as I look at him. I think he just looks confused all the time, and that's not what you're looking for, I don't think, in an NBA head coach.
I agree. All right, Mike. It's time to talk about Lakers Nuggets, which I wish would have gone longer than four games. Because I just think, I know we were texting a lot during those games. I just feel like the Lakers Nuggets was like, it was popcorn worthy. Well, I thought the games were really good. Like, I think we can agree, Mike, even though, like, we know the Nuggets won all the games, those four games could have gone either way. Right? Was there any, like, the first game probably being the exception, but the Lakers had their chances to win every game in that series, right? Would you agree?
I mean, I would say yes and no. I mean, the games were close, and the Lakers had the opportunity to make plays. But at the same time, I would argue that the reason why Denver won all four of those games is because Denver is better. Denver has more guys who can consistently make plays. And the bottom line is that Jokic just creates so many open looks and opportunities and, to be quite honest, easy baskets for himself or other guys that it just makes it really, really difficult if you're the other team.
Those two ridiculous shots he made yesterday?
Yeah, but those were baskets. Here's what I would say. Okay, so here's my response to that. This is exactly why I phrased it the way I did, is that he creates easy baskets for other guys. Some of the shots that he made, the two ridiculous step backs that he threw in over Anthony Davis in this series, what are you going to say? I mean, those are shots that, look, tremendous amount of skill to make those, but you're not making a very high percentage of them. But look, great players make those great shots. What I'm talking about more is just, it feels like in the last 2 minutes, in the last 5 minutes, in the fourth quarter, that Jokic just is able to create. How many easy layups and dunks did he get for Aaron Gordon just off back cuts or go screens or whatever it might be, where Gordon just slips into open space and Jokic has got the ball at the top and just is finding him? How much did he make Jamal Murray? Now, look, Murray went on the heater at the end of game three and then at the beginning of game four. But still, just the two-man game between Jokic and Murray and the dribble handoffs and the screens and the rescreens and everything that Jokic does to be able to get these guys open. Michael Porter Jr., look, you and I haven't really talked too much about Michael Porter Jr. this season, but there was a point a season ago or two seasons ago where we spent a lot of time talking about Michael Porter Jr., and I talked to you about how not only did I think the guy didn't really pass the ball very well, like playmaking skills, but I also told you that I don't even know if he could technically throw a pass from a fundamental skill standpoint. And I'm still not sure that he really can pass the ball. Like, his one defining skill is he can shoot the ball. And the reason why he can play on this team with the skill set that he has is because Jokic just finds him in spots where he can knock down shots. And he's a 6'10 dude that when he's open, the shots are going to go in. But everything just runs through Jokic, and I think that's the difference. LeBron of 2018, you put 2018 LeBron on the Lakers, and I think now you've got a seven-game series because LeBron would have been that same type of force for the Lakers. But this LeBron was not capable of going toe-to-toe from a playmaking and scoring standpoint with Jokic, because we saw it on the last play of the game where you and I were texting back and forth, what's he going to do? And I said, he's got to drive, but I expect him to shoot a terrible three. And he drove, but Murray basically got him in a jump ball situation, and he was surrounded. He just didn't get to where he needed to go. And look, I'm not going to sit here and criticize LeBron, who had 40 points in that game, and say that, oh, he's got to finish that play. But the reality is he's not as good as he was 6 years ago. And how could he possibly be? He's just not. And so I think the difference in this game or these games was, yeah, the Lakers were right there in every game, but Denver just had the little extra something, that something being Jokic, and their role players playing consistently well. Everybody who played for Denver, which basically was seven guys, every single one of those seven guys, I would say, played well. Whereas with the Lakers, we talked about this going into the series where it was going to be hit or miss with their role guys. Austin Reeves was great, I think, the whole series, but everybody else was kind of hit or miss. So I just think, yeah, the games were close,
I thought Rui Hachimura was really great this series for what he is.
Yeah, I guess you could say. I'd have to look at his box score for all four games and see how consistent he was over the course of those four games. But I agree, they got way more out of Hachimura than anybody in Washington would have guessed he could ever give to a playoff team that made the Western Conference Finals. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, Mike. Okay, so I guess let's just talk about this now. There's zero chance LeBron's retiring, right? This is a politicking and positioning move for LeBron to say, make this team better or I might consider retiring, correct?
You have to think, right? But at the same time, I guess what moves do the Lakers have in them? Is this
Kyrie Irving?
Is this
Kyrie
a pressure?
Irving's the move. Kyrie Irving's the move, Mike.
Okay, so let's take the Kyrie Irving move, right? So Kyrie Irving has already proven that he can play next to LeBron James, but he proved that he could play next to 2016 LeBron James, not what's going to be 2023, 2024 LeBron James. The last time the Lakers made a deal like this, and they're not going to trade for Kyrie Irving because he's an unrestricted free agent, but in order for them to sign Kyrie Irving, they're going to basically have to jettison all their role players, with the exception of, I think they can sign Austin Reeves to a fairly decent, whatever. I think Reeves is eligible to make, like, I want to say like $20 million, maybe something like that. And so I think if they sign him and then they were to sign Kyrie for basically his max, that the rest of their roster would have to be veteran minimum guys, which that's kind of the route they went with Russell Westbrook. Is that the route that LeBron is going to threaten to retire so that you can do that again? I mean, is that going to work? Is Reeves, year older LeBron, fragile AD, and kooky Kyrie, is that a championship team? Is that what LeBron wants to do? I mean, I don't know. I'm asking.
The answer is probably not, but I mean, the team that they've got is clearly not good enough to do it. So they got to do something, right?
If the team that they have now is not good enough to win an NBA championship, you're basically looking at either AD, who I don't think is going to be a guy that can look. AD had arguably what you could say was a really good playoff run, healthy, and had games where he was completely dominant. But AD as your best player, he's not a playmaker. He's not a guy who you're going to run the offense through.
I'm sorry, I'm going to say it. I'm going to be somewhat aggressive here. He's soft, Mike. He's soft. Like, I was not thinking that he was going to do anything in that game last night before the game even started. I said, there's no way that you're going to count on AD. You know, and he played all right offensively, but at least in the fourth, like the start of the fourth quarter, he kind of came alive. But he did not do anything. Like, going into that fourth quarter, I was like, AD is not going to win them this game. Because I just felt like he's just so soft, Mike. Any single time he takes a little bit of contact, I think he's going to get injured. He's just, I don't know. Maybe I'm being
he's too not that kind of player. He's not that player. I think you have to figure out what your expectation is for Anthony Davis, right? If you think Anthony Davis is a guy that is going to put your team on his back and win you a game, that's not the guy that he is. Now, maybe he can do that in the context of somebody else is setting him up. And I forget, which game did he have 40? Was that game one? Yeah, game one, he had 40 in the series. So he's capable of putting up big numbers, but he's not putting up big numbers in the same way that Jokic is at his position, or even what Joel Embiid did during the regular season. Like, I don't view AD as a guy that we bring the ball into the half court and we give it to Anthony Davis and then he goes to work. That's not the kind of guy he is. I see him as being a guy who plays off of somebody else. And so I do agree he's soft. I do agree that it feels like every time he goes up that he's going to be hurt. But the reality is he was great defensively for the first two series. And even in this series, I mean, he couldn't really handle Jokic one-on-one. And then when he was on Jokic, that limited his effectiveness in what he was doing really well in the first two series, which was disrupting kind of everything else that was going on. He had to spend so much time focused on Jokic that he couldn't roam and affect other guys in the lane by leaving Jokic, because you can't. I mean, Jokic, you got to guard him all over the floor. So that's why the Lakers made the adjustment and went to LeBron on Jokic and Hachimura on Jokic, because that then continued to allow Davis to be able to roam and disrupt things in the lane.
Yeah.
So I think from a defensive standpoint, Davis is as good when he's healthy. He's as good as anybody in the league defensively. And he's a really, 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 really high second tier offensive player. He's still going to be dependent on somebody else. So I guess my point is, and I think you're making the same point, that if this version of Anthony Davis is your best player, because LeBron is not as good as he once was, but still an incredibly good player, but he's not good enough to, like I talked about earlier, he's not good enough to go head to head with Jokic in a fourth quarter and do what he used to do, that I just don't think then this team is what it needs to be. Now, I would argue that if you bring in Kyrie, you're not really moving that needle, only because, look, the best version of those three guys, could that pairing make sense? Could adding Austin Reeves to that mix and then finding some veteran guys to fill out the roster, could that potentially work? I'd say the answer to that in their very best version could be yes, but what are the odds that LeBron and Davis stay healthy through next year's regular season and then through a playoff run, which is one of the reasons why everybody had questions about him this year? And then you throw the whole Kyrie, who knows what he's going to do, what he's thinking, what next thing is going to jump up and disrupt everything that's going on. To me, you're just signing up for maybe a better version of the Russell Westbrook situation, or maybe a worse one. I don't know. But it's not a situation that, if I was LeBron, I would not be threatening retirement to try to get the Lakers to bring in Kyrie Irving. Now, you could argue that they got to make changes in the roster, but I think that this team and their championship team and the Russell Westbrook team, for different reasons, prove that getting the one more star, to me, I don't think that's the way to go. At least not if that star is Kyrie. Maybe it's somebody else. Maybe if you can pry Damian Lillard out of Portland, maybe that makes sense. Because at least you know Dame is a stable presence. And even though he has flaws on the defensive end of the floor, if you have LeBron and Davis and some other role players, maybe you can make up for that. But to throw Kyrie Irving into this mix, to me, that doesn't make any sense. And so, no, I don't think LeBron's retiring, but I don't know what move he's pressuring the Lakers to make. It's interesting that he backed off the Bronny talk, too. So I have no idea. Who knows? LeBron obviously always has a motive, but I don't know what his motives are right now.
Yeah. Barkley wasn't too thrilled with that, by the way. I don't know if you saw that. He was not happy about this in the pregame show. They were talking about it, and he was not happy because that it seemed to take the spot. He wasn't upset with LeBron, I don't think, because it was the way that the questions were being asked. And I think LeBron was being LeBron, like answering the questions the way he always answers the questions. But Barkley wasn't thrilled because all the focus that should have been on the Nuggets being in the finals the first time, sweeping the Lakers, it had shifted away from them and had instead shifted to LeBron retiring. This is also the same guy who said that if anyone came up to him and told LeBron was better, he would smack him across the face and deal with whatever law enforcement had to do. So it is Charles Barkley. So
that clip was going around on the Twitter today. So anyways, I don't know. I think he's not. I don't think he's retiring. I don't think he's going to. I just don't see it. I don't see how it, someone else said, well, maybe he takes a year off. Maybe he pulls a Jordan and takes a year off, re-energizes the batteries and comes back a year later. But that doesn't make sense to me either, because he's too much of a – I think if he's – he's too much of a basketball junkie to just give it up for a year. I mean, obviously he would shoot and stuff, but not play a whole season and then come back. That I don't think that would be good for his legacy personally. I think that would be bad. I don't know how you feel on that. Like, if he said, I'm going to take a year off and then come back, what do you think? Is that bad? Is that good? Is that bad for his legacy? Or do you think it's indifferent? It doesn't really matter. What do you think, Mike?
I don't think it matters if he came back and then he won a title, right? I don't think it would matter. People would talk about it, but if he got a fifth title, I don't think the fact that he sat out a year would hurt him that much. Okay. But look, sitting out a year at this point and not playing that kind of high-level basketball and then trying to come back, you and I both know how it feels as you get older to not play all the time. Listen, and then Mike, try to play.
Like last week, I played three straight days. After the third straight day of playing, I thought my back was gonna disown me. So,
well, and in no way, shape, or form am I comparing you and I to LeBron James. But at the same time, if you sit out for a year,
pretty similar
it
game
just gets Mike, tougher. I think.
You yeah, basically you dunk. You basically dunk every time you take it to the lane. So I think it's pretty much.
I think LeBron's becoming more groundbound as his game is becoming more and more similar to mine as it goes along. So maybe by the time he's 78,
he's a little on the same level. He's sneaky quick, LeBron.
He's sneaky quick. Yeah, he's sneaky quick. I'll give him that. I don't think it matters if he were to come back and still be the first or second best player on a championship team. The fact that he sat out a year, especially when you think about the fact that the guy you're comparing him to in the GOAT debate would have sat out multiple seasons as well, that I don't think it would affect his legacy.
Multiple seasons. No, I'm just kidding. I'm joking.
Yeah, there you go. Frame it however you want. Frame it however you'd like. So I think the big thing there is just I don't think it would hurt him, but he'd have to come back at a really high level, and he'd have to win a title. And I don't know. I kind of half expected him when he walked out and started taking off the Lakers jersey. I expected him to have like a Cleveland undershirt, man. I thought your conspiracy theory was going to come through. He was going to be ripping off the Lakers jersey, listen, and
that's the move. That's
his
the move.
His undershirt was going to be a Cavaliers. Was going to be a Cavaliers practice shirt.
What? Mike, that's the move, right?
What?
Come to the Cavs. That's the move.
But he still has one more year left on the contract.
I don't understand why he signed that contract. It was asinine. It's a dumb move, LeBron.
That was not a good move. Compared to what he did when he was here, it just seems like, I don't know. The question becomes, and again, we could debate this forever, and we're not going to find the answer because LeBron is going to do what LeBron does. But I don't know. I just don't understand, other than the fact that he just basically is saying, like, I'm going to live here in L.A., and I might be unhappy with my situation with the Lakers, but I'm happy living in Los Angeles. This is where I want my family to be. And even though I might be unhappy in my basketball situation, I'm happy in my life outside of basketball. And look, that doesn't mean that he's not burning to win, but he's burning to win within the confines of, I'm going to stay in Los Angeles. And who knows, right or wrong, maybe that's the way that he's approached this thing, and that's why he signed the contract. But in all honesty, based on the way he's run his career up until signing that contract, it certainly goes against the grain of what he's always done. And it certainly limited his ability in this last year or two to impact real change, either through his own franchise or with the idea that he's going to go somewhere else. So it remains to be seen, but I don't know what he's going to do. But I don't think he's going to retire at this point.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so let's Nuggets. Like, are we in both agreements? Whoever wins the series in the East, the Nuggets are who we're picking to win the thing at this point.
Yeah, Denver's gonna wipe out either one of these teams.
Like, here's my question:
Denver in five, no matter who they play.
See, here's my thing. I think it's Denver in five if they play the Celtics, and Denver in six if they play the Heat. I give the Heat one win. I don't know why, but one additional win. I think they get two games. I think it would almost be like Denver, Miami, Denver. I just feel like,
yeah, I'm not saying you're wrong. I don't. I feel like that series is never going to be in doubt, even if one of those teams gets a game or two. I feel like Denver is just better. Like, their offense, Jokic just creates so many good shots for other guys. Yep. And then he's so good finishing around the basket. His touch around the hoop's incredible. And what I love most about what he's done in the playoffs, and I know he does it occasionally in the regular season, but I feel like he did it really well against the Lakers, is I love when he grabs the defensive rebound and – boom, he immediately just pivots, turns, and he's going full speed, which for him, it's hilarious when he starts running full speed, because
he's like
most NBA players, you see them running full speed and it looks like Usain Bolt running down the track. Like, it's smooth, it's natural. And you see Jokic running full speed, and it is like you can see every ounce of effort that he's throwing into trying to run full speed, whether he has the ball where he's pushing it himself or when he's just trying to beat the opposing center to get position down low. You can see him exerting effort to try to run as hard as he can. And the amount of times that he beat Lakers big man, whether it was Anthony Davis or whoever was guarding him, the amount of times that he beat guys up the floor and created like 5-on-3s when he pulled the ball off the defensive board, it was a ton. And that made a huge, huge difference. And when you have this guy who is his size, at his height, with his vision, leading the fast break, and then he just finds guys. Like, he'll come down and, okay, he's reading the defense, and a guy will jump to the three-point shooter who's the most likely pass, which is a guy maybe one pass away who's on the wing, and then Jokic will just kind of look at that guy, and then boom, he's skipping a pass down into the corner to a guy who's wide open for a three. And Denver's role players shot the ball really well, but part of the reason why they shoot the ball really well is because most of the time they're taking easy open shots, and they also know that they're going to get another chance if they miss, that he's just going to keep passing to them. Like, you could argue many, many times during that Lakers series that he probably should have taken more shots, where just back a guy down and get within 4 feet of the rim and then throw up one of his little floaters or step backs or half hooks or all the different things that he has in his bag. And yet there were many times when he passed the ball. And I think, look, the secret to basketball is not that hard to figure out. If your team plays unselfishly and shares the ball and you play hard, you are ahead of 98% of every basketball team out there at whatever level.
Yeah.
And I think Denver does those two things really, really well. Like, those guys are locked in. They want to keep moving without the ball because they know they're going to get it. And they know that if they pass it, they know they're going to get it back again. It's not like Michael Porter Jr. thinks, oh, if I don't shoot this shot, I might never get another shot in this game. He knows that the next time he's open and Jokic has the ball, guess what? He's going to get it again. And that's the secret to continue to get guys to cut hard and to move on offense and to continue to give effort on the defensive end of the floor. And Jokic just makes every single one of those guys better. And then just what he can do offensively as a guy with the ball, he doesn't look like your prototypical, hey, we can give this guy the ball and he can go get us a bucket. But that drive he had in game four from the wing where he went full speed left and then bumped Anthony Davis off and got right to the rim, that was with, like, I don't know, maybe a minute to go when they were, it was either tied or maybe they were up two. I mean, that was just an incredible move to the basket by a guy who we don't think of him as having tremendous athleticism, but the strength, the eye-hand coordination, the touch, we sometimes underestimate what those things are when we talk about athletic ability. And yeah, he's not playing above the square and he's not the fastest guy end to end. But sometimes if you just have a tremendous amount of skill and then you maximize that skill by playing as hard as you can and running as hard as you can, that's really what it's all about. And Jokic is just, I mean, he's so much fun to watch because he's just not a prototypical NBA star. And he has that passing gene that, if you appreciate basketball, it's a reason why people like Bird. It's a reason why people like Magic, because they make everybody better and they keep everybody involved in the game. And yet the thing I like about Jokic is you can still give him a ball at the end of a game. And if you need a bucket, he can get you one. And so to me, he's the best of both worlds.
Okay. I mean, I agree. I think, then listen, the Nuggets are going to wipe the floor. They're going to win the series. They're the NBA champions. I'm crowning them. Bew, congratulations. hopefully you've been able to watch some of the games since they're on national TV and you don't have to worry about altitude and all that nonsense. But the Nuggets are going to win. There's just no doubt in my mind. Mike, I saw an interesting thing go around. You know, the Nuggets should send a ring to Carmelo if they win it.
Because
they got Jamal Murray with the Carmelo pick or the trade.
Okay.
So that they pick
Spike. Murray's been great. I mean, you saw the stat that his playoff points per game jump from the regular season, I think, is the highest of any player in history.
It's pretty amazing. I did not see that, but pretty amazing. I mean,
I think he averages like 28 a game in the playoffs, and he's like a career 19-point scorer in the regular season.
That's pretty crazy.
It is. And I think Murray, when I look at him, he's almost the perfect counterpoint to Jokic. It's sort of like the Kyrie-LeBron situation in that Kyrie was never a great distributor. Kyrie's never going to average 10 assists a game. I don't think Jamal Murray's ever going to average 10 assists a game as a point guard. But because of his ability to score and his ability to work off that two-man game with Jokic the same way Kyrie was able to work with LeBron and then score when LeBron wasn't in the game, this Murray-Jokic pairing reminds me a ton of the LeBron-Kyrie pairing in terms of how they sort of fill one another's, and I don't even want to say gaps, but they fit together really well and they work together really well in the two-man game. And it has to be, like I said, playing with Jokic and just knowing that you're going to get the ball back. And the fact that Murray was able to carry them for big stretches. It just makes a huge difference when you know that you have two guys that can do it on a really, really high level and have proven it in the playoffs. I mean, both these guys now, when you look at their playoff resumes, man, I know there was, and I'm not sure why, but there was some Jokic doubt about what he was as a playoff player coming into these playoffs. Hey,
by the way, Mark Jackson's talking about how great of a player he is and all that stuff. You left him off the ballot, you idiot.
I do love that, how he's, I do love listening to him and think, like, how do you leave the guy off your all-star ballot? Makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, Mike, our favorite tweeter has tweeted.
Okay, what did he tweet this time?
Irvin Magic Johnson. This is, you know, he tweeted this 9 minutes ago.
Okay.
Congratulations, Nikola Jokic, for being named the Irvin Magic Johnson Western Conference Finals MVP and averaging 27 points, 14.7 rebounds, and 11.3 assists for the series. Fire emoji.
Nice.
But, oh, it's not over.
Oh,
then
there's more.
Irvin Magic Johnson then retweets on his next second tweet, follow-up tweet, "The Joker is changing the game of basketball right before our eyes, much like Michael, Larry, LeBron, Steph, Kobe, Kareem, and Shaq."
All right. Hey, that's legit. You saying he should have included himself in there?
Well, no, I don't think that would be narcissistic, but I think what I'm saying is, why is he tweeting this tonight and not yesterday? Or during the day
just
today.
Just wants people to know. Hey, he was thinking about it all day.
So, anyways.
Magic's always got some good insights.
He's got some good insights. And he's followed this up with a tweet about the Dodgers. So, anyways. I don't know what if you have anything else, Mike. I don't really have anything else to say. I guess to be determined.
The lottery. We didn't talk at all about the lottery.
Do we really want to talk about the lottery right now? I mean,
what are your thoughts? Just give me your 30-second take on the lottery. I'll give you
my 30-second take is that Wembanyama shouldn't be any. There isn't anywhere else he would be happier. I don't think going to. Maybe the prospects of San Antonio. As long as you're not talking to Charles Barkley, that is. But the prospects of San Antonio going. Like, it's a perfect place for him as long as Pop is around. It's a perfect culture. I think it's going to be great. Did you see the picture of him and Rudy Gobert?
Yes.
That was circulating that Rudy Gobert is 7-1 and Victor Wembanyama. It looks like he's making Rudy Gobert look short. So it'll be very, very, very interesting to see him play. I mean, the rest of the lottery, ho-hum, right? Like, I don't really, like... The big one was who was getting number one. San Antonio got it. Great for San Antonio. Great for him because it should theoretically be a good fit. And yeah, that's what I have to say. I don't really have any other takes other than that, Mike. It was pretty much chalk all the way down for the most part, right?
Portland jumping up and Detroit falling to five, right? Was the one thing that was
Detroit deserved to fall to five because they've had a lot of picks in the top in a while, the last few years, so make them fall out.
There you go. Look, I agree with you 100%. There was no better place for Wembanyama to go. If you want him to be a guy who's going to reach his full potential, you want him to start out in a place that is proven in terms of their ability to develop players, win games, and obviously you have Popovich there who – if he's not the best coach in the history of the league, he's certainly one of the best. And the infrastructure that you have in San Antonio, if we want to see what Victor Wembanyama can become in terms of reaching the potential that he has, there was no better spot for him to land. You look at the rest of the top five, six, seven teams, and you had a lot of dysfunction there where potentially he could have gone. Now, maybe on the basketball floor, when you just look about terms of the talent surrounding him, maybe you could argue that there are a few better places that he could have gone. But in terms of his development, I think that if you're Wembanyama and his people, you have to be ecstatic that he ended up in San Antonio. From the league standpoint, that's the argument for San Antonio, that you're going to get the best of this guy, putting him in that environment. San Antonio is still a small market, so I think the only thing that the league might have wanted is for him to go to a bigger market. But they're really – was no big market teams that had a shot or at least a legitimate shot of landing him. So I think from a league standpoint, this is where you want him to go. And then the only other thing, like I said, that's interesting is Portland moving up to number three. And now that gives them either the ability to trade that pick and maybe Shaedon Sharpe or Anthony Simons or some other things and try to get some veteran help for Lillard, or maybe yeah. you just make that pick and you try to build with Shaedon Sharpe and keep Simons and then whoever this number three pick is, whether it ends up being Scoot or Brandon Miller, depending on how things fall ahead of them, that's the only part that really made it interesting, the rest of the lottery, and then Detroit obviously falling to number five, which I'm sure they were hugely disappointed. And I think from a purely basketball standpoint, that would have been a fun place for Wembanyama to go, just if you think about the young guys that they already have, that would have been a fun core for him to play with. But I'm not sure, again, that Detroit would have been the best situation. They still, I don't think they hired a coach. There was a lot of Troy Weaver discussion in terms of what's he doing in their coaching search as the Pistons GM. It seems like they're kind of floundering and maybe
Mike, I've not followed any of that. I'll be completely honest with you.
All right. Well, they've been kind of, I think.
I don't have a take.
All right. Well, there you go. So anyway, I guess the bottom line is I think Wembanyama ended up in the best possible spot for him and probably the best possible spot for the league as a whole, just because, again, you want this guy to be able to live up to his potential. And so we'll see what happens. Obviously, there's no guarantees, but it certainly seems like this guy is a generational prospect. And we'll see when he gets to the league what he's capable of doing. You hear all kinds of hyperbole and how great he's going to be, but who knows? Obviously, he's got to step out on the court and be able to prove it. Based on the limited amount of things that I've seen and then some of the things that I've read and heard people talking about, he seems like if he stays healthy that he's about as much of a sure thing as we've seen, certainly since LeBron. And if he's that good at that size, man, it'll be fun to watch at least.
I agree. And we'll just have to see what happens.
Yep. Other than that, I don't have anything. There really hasn't been any big coaching hires. So we're still waiting on seeing what's going to happen with some of these jobs and who's going to get them. So we will next week on Tuesday, we will hopefully have our preview, correct? Because that will be that'll be like a day or two before the finals. So we will know finals will be set by the time we have that discussion.
Yeah, the game Sunday. If it somehow manages to get all the way to Sunday, then it'll be set Sunday. So
yeah, so we'll have our finals preview next week, although we kind of already previewed the preview in that I don't think it matters who comes out of the East, that both of us are going to pick Denver, but we'll be able to talk at least about some of the matchups and we'll be able to revisit how the Heat Celtics series played itself out. And yep, either the Celtics will complete a historic comeback and the Heat will have a historic collapse, or we'll continue to have this Cinderella Miami story moving forward. So I think we'll end it there unless you have something else.
I have nothing.
All right. Let's wrap it there. We appreciate everyone checking us out tonight here on this NBA edition of the Hoopheads Pod. And we will be back next week for our 2023 NBA Finals preview. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your coaching portfolio guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.